he sent his sons ahead with the more warlike of the soldiers, while he himself advanced with the rest of the force by another route, setting many ambushes for the enemy in the ravines of the mountains. He failed in none of his undertakings, and having prevailed over the enemy on every front, spent the rest of his life in peace, having also made an alliance with the Romans. He ruled the Jews 8 years in all, and died through a plot laid against him at a banquet by Ptolemy, his son-in-law, who seized Simon's wife and two of his sons, held them bound, and sent men also against the third son, John, who was also named Hyrcanus, to kill him. But the young man, learning of their approach, escaped the danger and hurried into the city, trusting in the people because of his father's benefactions and because of the people's hatred of Ptolemy. Ptolemy also tried eagerly to enter by another gate, but the people, having already welcomed Hyrcanus, drove him back. So Ptolemy withdrew to one of the strongholds above Jericho, called Dagon. Hyrcanus, having recovered the ancestral high priesthood and offered the first sacrifices to God, marched out against Ptolemy, and attacking the stronghold got the better of him everywhere except in the one respect of his pity for his mother and brothers. For Ptolemy brought them up onto the wall in full view and tortured them, threatening to hurl them down if Hyrcanus did not abandon the siege. Hyrcanus's eagerness for taking the place would slacken by exactly as much as he thought he was sparing his loved ones further suffering by relenting. But his mother, stretching out her hands, begged him not to soften on her account, but rather to press on all the harder in his anger to take the place and punish the enemy once he had him in his power, avenging their loved ones. For death by torture would be sweet to her, she said, if the man who had done such lawless things to them paid the penalty for it. Hearing his mother say this, Hyrcanus felt some impulse to press the siege, but whenever he saw her being struck and torn, he weakened and gave way to pity for what was being done to her. As the siege thus dragged on, the year arrived in which the Jews observe rest, for they keep this practice every 7 years, as on the days of the week. And Ptolemy, relieved from the war by this, killed the brothers of Hyrcanus and their mother. His mother, and having done this, he fled to Zeno, called Cotyles, the tyrant of the city of Philadelphia. Antiochus, angry at what he had suffered at Simon's hands, invaded Judea in the fourth year of his own reign, the first year of Hyrcanus's rule, in the 162nd Olympiad. He ravaged the countryside and shut Hyrcanus up in the city itself, which he surrounded with 7 camps, but at first he accomplished nothing at all, both because of the strength of the walls and the valor of the besieged, and also, for a time, because of a shortage of water, from which a heavy rainstorm at the setting of the Pleiades released them. On the north side of the wall, where the ground happened to be level, he raised 103-story towers and set military detachments on them, making daily assaults and cutting a deep and very wide double trench. He walled the inhabitants off completely. They devised many sallies in response. Whenever they fell upon the enemy unguarded, they did them great damage, but when the enemy took notice, they withdrew with ease. When Hyrcanus realized that the great number of people inside was a liability, since provisions were being consumed too quickly by it, and no work worth mentioning was being done by so many idle hands, he separated out the useless part of the population and cast it out, keeping only those who were in their prime and fit for fighting. Antiochus, for his part, would not let those who had been expelled leave the siege lines, and they, caught between the walls and abused with such hardships, died miserably. But when the Feast of Tabernacles came round, those inside took pity on them and let them back in again. When Hyrcanus sent to Antiochus and asked that a truce of 7 days be granted for the festival, Antiochus yielded, out of reverence for the divine, and granted the truce. More than that, he sent in a magnificent sacrifice, bulls with gilded horns and cups full of every kind of spice, of gold and of silver. Those stationed at the gates received the sacrifice from the men bringing it and carried it into the temple, while Antiochus feasted his army, in this differing enormously from Antiochus Epiphanes, who, when he took the city, sacrificed pigs on the altar and sprinkled the temple with their broth, throwing Jewish law and their ancestral piety into confusion, for which the nation was provoked to war against him and remained irreconcilable. This Antiochus, however, everyone called Eusebs, the pious, on account of the excess of his reverence. Hyrcanus, welcoming his fair dealing and recognizing his zeal for the divine, sent envoys to him asking that he restore to them their ancestral constitution. He rejected the plot against them, though some urged him to wipe out the nation because of its refusal to mix its way of life with that of others. He paid them no heed, and being persuaded to act in all things out of reverence, he answered the envoys that the besieged should surrender their weapons and pay tribute for Jaffa and the other cities outside Judea, and that upon accepting a garrison on these terms, they would be released from the war. They agreed to everything else, but would not consent to the garrison, since because of their refusal to mix with others, they had no dealings with outsiders. In place of the garrison, however, they gave hostages and 500 talents of silver, of which the king immediately received 300 along with the hostages, among whom was Hyacinus's own brother, and he also tore down the city's crownwork. On these terms, Antiochus lifted the siege and withdrew. Hyacinus then opened the tomb of David, who had surpassed all kings before him in wealth, and took out 3,000 talents of silver. And with this money, he became the first of the Jews to begin maintaining foreign mercenaries. He also came to be on terms of friendship and alliance with Antiochus, and receiving him into the city, he provided everything for his army generously and with great munificence. When Antiochus made his campaign against the Parthians, Hyacinus joined the expedition with him. Nicolaus of Damascus bears witness to this for us, recording it as follows. After setting up a trophy at the Lycus River upon defeating in Dates, the Parthian general Antiochus remained there 2 days at the request of Hyacinus the Jew, because of a certain ancestral festival, during which it was not lawful for Jews to travel. And in saying this, Nicolaus does not lie, for the feast of Pentecost had fallen right after the Sabbath, and it is not permitted for us to travel either on the Sabbath or on a festival. Antiochus, however, engaged Arsaces the Parthian, lost a great part of his army, and himself perished. And his brother Demetrius succeeded to the kingdom of the Syrians, Arsaces having released him from captivity at the very time when Antiochus was invading Parthia, as we have already shown elsewhere. When Hyacinus heard of Antiochus's death, he at once marched out against the cities of Syria, expecting to find them, as indeed he did, stripped of fighting men able to defend them. Medaba, after his army had suffered greatly there, he took in the 6th month. Then he immediately took Samoga and the places nearby, and besides these Shechem and Gerizim, and the nation of the Cutheans, who dwell around the temple built in imitation of the one at Jerusalem, which Alexander had permitted Sanballat the governor to build for the sake of his son-in-law Manasseh, brother of Jadus the high priest, as we have shown before. It happened that this temple was left desolate 200 years after its founding. Hyacinus also took the cities of Adora and Marissa in Idumea, and having brought all the Idumeans under his power, he allowed them to remain in the land on condition that they circumcise themselves and adopt the laws of the Jews. And out of longing for their ancestral land, they submitted to circumcision and to the rest of the Jewish way of life, and from that time on they came to count as Jews. Hyacinus the high priest, wishing to renew friendship with the Romans, sent an embassy to them. The Senate, receiving the letter from him, made a treaty of friendship with him in this manner. Fannius, son of Marcus, praetor, convened the Senate 8 days before the Ides of February, in the Comitium, in the presence of Lucius Manlius, son of Lucius, of the Mentine tribe, and Gaius Sempronius, son of Pennus, of the Falernian tribe, concerning the matters on which Simon, son of Dositheus, and Apollonius, son of Alexander, and Diodorus, son of Jason, honorable men sent by the people of the Jews, had spoken, having discussed the friendship and alliance existing between them and the Romans, and matters of state, asking that Jaffa and its harbors and Gazara and its springs, and whatever other cities and territories of theirs Antiochus had taken by war contrary to the decree of the Senate be restored to them, and that it not be permitted for the king's soldiers to pass through their territory and that of their subjects, and that whatever had been decreed against them in that war by Antiochus contrary to the decree of the Senate be rendered void, and that ambassadors be sent to see that what had been taken from them by Antiochus be restored, and that the land ravaged in the war be assessed for compensation, and that letters be given to them for kings and free peoples for the safety of their return home. It was resolved concerning these matters as follows. to renew friendship and alliance with good men sent by a good and friendly people. But concerning the letters, they answered that they would deliberate on this once the Senate had leisure from its own affairs, and that they would take care that no such injustice be done to them in future, and that Fannius the praetor should give them money from the public treasury for their return home. Fannius accordingly dismissed the Jewish envoys in this way, having given them money from the public treasury and a decree of the Senate for those who would escort them and see to their safe arrival home. Such, then, was the state of affairs concerning Hyacinus the high priest. As for King Demetrius, though eager to march against Hyacinus, he had neither the occasion nor the means to do so, since the Syrians and his own soldiers hated him, for he was a wicked man. And when they sent envoys to Ptolemy called Physcon, asking that he hand over to them one of the descendants of Seleucus to take the kingdom, Ptolemy sent Alexander, called Zabinas, with an army, and when battle was joined with Demetrius, Demetrius, defeated in the battle, fled to his wife Cleopatra at Ptolemais. And when his wife would not receive him, he went from there to Tyre, was seized, and after suffering much at the hands of those who hated him, died. Alexander, having taken the kingdom, made friendship with Hyacinus the high priest. Then, when Demetrius's son, called Antiochus Gripus, made war on him, he was defeated in battle and destroyed. When Antiochus took over the kingdom of Syria, he was wary of campaigning against Judea, hearing that his half-brother, also called Antiochus, was gathering a force against him from Cyzicus. Remaining where he was, he set about preparing himself against his brother's attack, the brother who was called Cyzicus, because he had been raised in that city, and whose father was Antiochus called Soter, who had died among the Parthians. This man was the brother of Gripus's father. As it happened, one and the same Cleopatra had married both brothers, as we have related elsewhere. Cyzicus Antiochus, arriving in Syria, spent many years continuing to make war on his brother. All that time Hyacinus lived in peace, for after Antiochus's death he had broken away from the Macedonians and no longer offered them anything, whether as subject or as friend, but his affairs prospered greatly and reached their height in the time of Alexander Zabinas, and especially amid the strife of these two brothers. For their war against one another gave Hyacinus the leisure to enjoy Judea in safety, so that he amassed a boundless quantity of wealth. When Cyzicus openly ravaged his land, Hyacinus in turn showed his own resolve, and seeing Antiochus deprived of his allies from Egypt, and both him and his brother faring badly in their struggles against one another, he despised them both. And he marched against Samaria, a very well-fortified city, concerning which, since it is now called Sebest, having been founded by Herod, we shall speak in its proper place. Attacking it vigorously, he laid siege to it, out of hatred of wrongdoing toward the Samaritans, on behalf of the people of Marissa, colonists of the Jews and their allies, whom the Samaritans had wronged while obeying the kings of Syria. Surrounding the city on every side with a trench and a double wall about 80 stadia in circumference, he set his sons Antigonus and Aristobulus over the siege. Under this pressure, the Samaritans were driven by necessity of famine to such extremes that they touched even forbidden foods and called on Antiochus Cyzicus for help. He readily came to their aid but was defeated by Aristobulus's forces and, pursued by the brothers as far as Scythopolis, made his escape. Those besieging the Samaritans, turning back, shut them up again within their wall, so that they sent a second time to call on the same Antiochus as their ally. He, having summoned from Ptolemy Lathyrus about 6,000 men, whom Ptolemy's mother sent out unbeknownst to him, she was on the verge of driving him from his throne, at first advanced and plundered Hyacinus's territory like a bandit together with the Egyptians, not daring to meet him face to face, since his forces were not equal to it, but thinking that by ravaging the land he would force Hyacinus to abandon the siege of Samaria. But when he lost many of his soldiers by falling into ambushes, he withdrew to Tripolis, entrusting the war against the Jews to Callimander and Epicrates. Callimander, engaging the enemy too rashly, was routed and killed on the spot. Epicrates, out of love of money, openly betrayed Scythopolis and the other places near it to the Jews, but was unable to break up the siege of Samaria. Hyacinus then took the city after besieging it for a year, and was not content with this alone, but utterly destroyed it, making it subject to flooding by the winter torrents. For he dug it out so thoroughly, turning it into ravines, that he removed every trace of its ever having been a city. A strange thing is also told concerning the high priest Hyrcanus, how the divine came to speak with him. They say that on that very day on which his sons fought against Cyzicenus, he himself, while alone in the temple burning incense as high priest, heard a voice saying that his sons had just now defeated Antiochus. And coming out of the temple, he made this known to the whole assembled people, and so indeed it turned out to be. Such, then, was the state of affairs concerning Hyrcanus. At this same time, it happened that not only the Jews in Jerusalem and the countryside were prospering, but also those living in Alexandria and in Egypt and Cyprus. For Queen Cleopatra, at odds with her son Ptolemy called Lathyrus, appointed as commanders Chalcias and Ananias, sons of Onias who had built the temple in the district of Heliopolis in imitation of the one in Jerusalem, as we have shown before. Cleopatra entrusted to these men her army and did nothing apart from their counsel, as Strabo of Cappadocia also testifies for us, saying as follows. For most of the men, both those who had joined originally and those later sent by Cleopatra to Cyprus, went over at once to Ptolemy. Only the Jews descended from Onias remained loyal, because their fellow citizens Chalcias and Ananias were held in especially high esteem by the queen. So much, then, Strabo says. But prosperity stirred up envy of Hyrcanus among the Jews, and above all the Pharisees, one sect of the Jews, as we have shown above, were ill-disposed toward him. So great is their influence with the populace that even when they say anything against a king or a high priest, they are believed at once. Hyrcanus, too, had been a disciple of theirs and was greatly loved by them. And once, when he had invited them to a banquet and entertained them warmly, seeing that they were thoroughly enjoying themselves, he began to say to them that they knew he wished to be righteous and to do everything by which he might please God and them, for the Pharisees are philosophers. He asked further, he said, however, that if they saw him doing wrong and straying from the path of justice, they should bring him back to it and set him right. When they had all testified to his complete virtue, he was delighted with their praise. But one of the guests reclining there, a man named Eleazar, malicious by nature and fond of strife, said, "Since you have asked to know the truth and wish to be a just man, lay down the high priesthood and be content to rule the people alone." When Hyrcanus asked his reason for demanding that he give up the high priesthood, Eleazar answered, "Because we hear from our elders that your mother was a captive in the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes." The story was false, and Hyrcanus was furious at him, and all the Pharisees were bitterly indignant as well. Among the Sadducees, whose party holds the opposite views to the Pharisees, a certain Jonathan, one of Hyrcanus's closest friends, said that Eleazar had spoken his slander with the backing of the whole body of the Pharisees, and that this would become clear if Hyrcanus asked them what penalty they thought the man deserved for what he had said. So Hyrcanus asked the Pharisees what punishment they thought he deserved. For he would judge, he said, that the slander had not been spoken with their sanction if they set a penalty proportioned to the offense. And they replied that he deserved stripes and chains, for they did not think it right to punish a man with death for mere abuse. And besides, the Pharisees are by nature lenient in matters of punishment. At this Hyrcanus grew very angry, and became convinced that the man had indeed spoken his slander with their approval. Jonathan in particular kept inflaming him further, and worked on him to such effect that he induced him to go over to the Sadducean party, abandoning the Pharisees, to repeal the ordinances they had established for the people, and to punish those who observed them. From this arose the hatred that the people bore toward him and his sons. But of these matters, we shall speak again later. For now, I wish to explain that the Pharisees had handed down to the people certain regulations from the tradition of their fathers, which are not recorded in the laws of Moses. And for this reason, the Sadducean party rejects them, holding that only what is written should be considered binding, while what comes from the tradition of the fathers need not be observed. Concerning these matters, great disputes and disagreements arose between them, the Sadducees persuading only the wealthy, without the common people following them, while the Pharisees had the mass of the people as their allies. But I have set out the details concerning these two parties, and the Essenes as well, with precision in the second book of my Jewish War. Hyacinus, having put an end to the sedition and afterward lived happily, and having administered his rule in the best possible manner for 31 years, died, leaving 5 sons. He had been judged by God worthy of the 3 greatest things: rule of the nation, the honor of the high priesthood, and the gift of prophecy. For the divine presence was with him, and gave him foreknowledge of the future, so that he knew and foretold things to come. Indeed, he even predicted, concerning his 2 elder sons, that they would not remain masters of affairs. It is worth relating the disaster that befell them, to show how far short they fell of their father's good fortune. When their father died, the eldest, Aristobulus, decided to change the government into a monarchy, for this was his judgment, and was the first to place a diadem on his head, 481 years and 3 months after the people, freed from servitude to the Babylonians, had returned to their own land. Of his brothers, he loved the one next to him in age, Antigonus, and treated him as an equal, but kept the others in chains. He also imprisoned his mother, who had quarreled with him over the rule, for Hyacinus had left her mistress of the whole realm, and he carried his cruelty so far that he starved her to death in her bonds. He added to his mother's fate his brother Antigonus as well, whom he seemed to love most of all and had made his partner in the kingship, having been estranged from him by slanders which at first he did not believe, partly because his affection for him kept him from paying attention to what was said, and partly because he supposed the slander arose from envy of him. But once, when Antigonus had returned splendidly from a campaign at the very time of the festival on which they build booths for God, it happened that Aristobulus fell ill, while Antigonus went up to the temple to celebrate the festival, magnificently arrayed, with armed men about him, and prayed at length for his brother's recovery. But wicked men, eager to destroy the harmony between the brothers, seized on the opportunity presented by the ostentation of Antigonus's procession and by his own successes, went to the king, and maliciously exaggerated the display made at the procession during the festival, saying that none of what had happened befitted a private citizen, but that his actions showed the ambition of a king, and that he intended to kill Aristobulus, having come with a strong body of guards, reasoning foolishly that though it was in his power to be king himself, he was content to seem to receive great honor by accepting a lesser rank. Aristobulus, reluctantly persuaded by this, and at the same time wishing to appear free of suspicion toward his brother while also taking care for his own safety, stationed his bodyguards in a certain unlit underground passage. He himself lay ill in the fortress later renamed Antonia, and ordered them to lay hands on no one who was unarmed, but to kill Antigonus if he came into him armed. He sent word to Antigonus, however, asking him to come to him unarmed. But the queen and those conspiring with her against Antigonus persuaded the messenger to say the opposite, that his brother, having heard he had procured weapons and equipment of war, urged him to come to him armed, so that he might see the equipment. Antigonus, suspecting no treachery but trusting in his brother's goodwill toward him, came to Aristobulus just as he was, dressed in full armor, to show him the weapons. When he reached the place called the Tower of Strato, where the passage happened to be very dark, the bodyguards killed him. His death showed clearly that nothing is stronger than envy and slander, and nothing more capable of destroying goodwill and natural kinship than these passions. One may especially marvel at a certain Judas, an Essene by birth, who never once spoke falsely in his predictions. For this man, seeing Antigonus passing by the temple, cried out to his companions and disciples, who stayed with him to learn how to foretell the future, that it would be good for him to die now, since he had been proved false, Antigonus being still alive. The man whom he had predicted would die that day at the place called the Tower of Strato, though he now saw him alive, and though that place was about 600 stadia distant, and most of the day had already passed, so that his prophecy was in danger of proving false. While he was saying this, downcast, word came that Antigonus had died in the underground chamber that was also called the Tower of Strato, sharing its name with the coastal city of Caesarea. This news threw the prophet into confusion. As for Aristobulus, remorse for the killing of his brother seized him at once, along with an illness brought on by it, his mind so afflicted by the pollution that the unmixed force of his anguish caused blood to rise within him and be brought up. One of the servant boys attending him, by what I take to be divine providence, slipped while carrying this blood away to the very spot where the stains of Antigonus's blood still remained from his murder, and spilled it there. A cry arose from those who saw it, supposing that the boy had deliberately poured the blood there. Aristobulus, hearing this, asked the reason for the outcry, and when they would not tell him, he pressed all the more to learn it, for it is human nature to suspect that things kept silent in such circumstances are worse than they are. When, by threats and by forcing them with fear, they told him the truth, many tears burst from him, his mind stricken by the awareness of his own guilt, and with a deep groan he said, "So it was not, after all, going to escape the notice of God, that I should attempt such impious and abominable crimes. But a swift penalty for a kinsman's murder has overtaken me. And how long, most shameless body, will you hold a soul owed to a brother and a mother, delivering it to the powers below? Why do you not give it back all at once, rather than pouring out my blood drop by drop as a libation to those I have murdered?" With these words he died, having reigned for 1 year. He was called a Philhellene, and he did much good for his country, waging war against the Etrurians and adding a large part of their territory to Judea, and compelling the inhabitants, if they wished to remain in the country, to be circumcised and to live according to the laws of the Jews. He was naturally of a mild disposition and remarkably modest, as Strabo also attests, quoting Timagenes in these words, "This man was of a mild character and of great service to the Jews, for he added territory to their land, and he brought a portion of the Etrurian nation into kinship with them by the bond of circumcision of their private parts." When Aristobulus died, his wife Selina, called Alexandra by the Greeks, released his brothers, whom Aristobulus had kept in chains, as we have said, and made Janius, also called Alexander, king, since he was the eldest and the most moderate in temperament. It happened that as soon as he was born, he was hated by his father, and never once came into his sight until his father's death. The reason for this hatred is said to have been as follows. Hyacinus, loving most among his sons the elder ones, Antigonus and Aristobulus, once asked God in a dream which of his sons was to succeed him. When God showed him this one's features, Hyacinus was grieved that he was to be heir to all his goods and allowed him, once born, to be raised in Galilee. God, however, did not deceive Hyacinus. This son, taking over the kingdom after Aristobulus's death, put to death the one brother who attempted to seize the throne and kept the other, who chose to live quietly in honor. Having established the government in the manner he thought advantageous to himself, he marched against Ptolemais, and having prevailed in battle, he shut the people up within the city, surrounded them, and besieged them. For along the coast, only Ptolemais and Gaza remained to be subdued by him, along with Zoilus, the tyrant who held the tower of Strato and Dora. Since Antiochus Philometor and his brother Antiochus, surnamed Cyzicenus, were at war with one another and destroying their own forces, no help could come to the people of Ptolemais from them. But while they were being worn down by the siege, Zoilus, who held the tower of Strato, and who maintained a body of soldiers at Dora and was attempting to set up a tyranny, gave them some small assistance because of the rivalry between the two kings. For the kings were not on such friendly terms with the Ptolemaeans that they could hope for any help from them. Both kings were in the same case as athletes who, having given up hope of victory through their own strength but ashamed to withdraw, continue the contest through inactivity and delay. Their remaining hope lay with the kings of Egypt and with Ptolemy Lathyrus, who held Cyprus, having been driven from his throne by his mother Cleopatra and taken refuge there. The people of Ptolemais therefore sent to him and urged him to come as an ally and rescue them from the hands of Alexander, since they were in danger. The envoys raised his hopes, telling him that once he crossed into Syria, he would find the people of Gaza allied with the Ptolemaeans and with Zoilus, and the Sidonians too, and many others ready to join him. And, elated at this, he hastened to set sail. Meanwhile, however, a certain Demaenetus, a persuasive man who held sway with the people of Ptolemais at the time and swayed the assembly, made them change their minds, saying it was better to run the risk of an uncertain outcome fighting the Jews than to accept open slavery by handing themselves over to a master. And that besides, they would face not only their present war, but a far greater one from Egypt as well. for Cleopatra would not stand by and allow Ptolemy to build up a force so close to her borders, but would come against them with a great army, since she was eager even to drive her son out of Cyprus. And if Ptolemy's hopes failed, Cyprus remained open to him as a refuge, while for them it meant the utmost danger. Ptolemy, learning during his crossing of the change of mind among the people of Ptolemais, sailed on nonetheless, and putting in at the place called Sycaminon, disembarked his forces there. His whole army numbered about 30,000, infantry and cavalry together, and leading them up near Ptolemais he encamped. But since the city would not receive his envoys nor listen to his proposals, he was greatly troubled. When Zoilus and the people of Gaza came to him and begged him to join them as an ally, since their territory was being ravaged by the Jews and by Alexander, Alexander, fearing Ptolemy, lifted the siege and withdrew his army to his own territory, where he continued to maneuver, secretly summoning Cleopatra against Ptolemy while openly pretending friendship and alliance with him. He even promised to pay 400 talents of silver in return for a favor, that Ptolemy remove the tyrant Zoilus and hand over his territory to the Jews. At that time Ptolemy, gladly making friendship with Alexander, seized Zoilus. But afterward, hearing that Alexander had secretly sent word to his mother Cleopatra, he broke the oaths he had made with him, attacked and besieged Ptolemais, since it had refused to receive him. Leaving generals in charge of the siege along with part of his forces, he himself set out with the rest to subdue Judea. Alexander, learning Ptolemy's intention, gathered about 50,000 of his own countrymen, some writers say 80,000, and taking this force went to meet Ptolemy. Ptolemy fell suddenly upon Asaches, a city of Galilee, on the Sabbath, took it by storm, and captured about 10,000 people along with much other plunder. Having also made an attempt on Sepphoris, a little distance from the city he had ravaged, and lost many men there, he set out to fight Alexander. Alexander met him near the Jordan River, at a place called Asophon, not far from the Jordan, and pitched his camp near the enemy. He had 8,000 men in his front line, whom he called the 100 fighters, equipped with bronze armor. Ptolemy's frontline troops also carried bronze-plated shields, but the rest of his men were more lightly armed, and so they went into the fight more cautiously. Their courage was greatly bolstered, though, by the tactician Philistephanus, who ordered them to cross the river between the two camps. Alexander did not think it worth preventing the crossing, since he calculated that if he pinned the enemy against the river at their backs, he would more easily defeat them, as they would have no way to flee the battle. At first, the fighting on both sides was matched in effort and determination, and heavy slaughter fell on both armies alike. But when Alexander's men began to gain the advantage, Philistephanus split his force and sent reinforcements to the wing that was giving way. Since none of the Jews on the collapsing side received support from their neighbors, who instead of helping them joined in the flight, they broke and ran. Ptolemy's men did the opposite. They pressed the pursuit and cut the Jews down, chasing and killing the routed troops until their swords grew blunt with the killing and their arms gave out from exhaustion. It was said that 30,000 of them died. Timagenes puts the number at 50,000, while of the rest some were taken captive and others escaped to their own towns. After the victory, Ptolemy overran the countryside, and when evening came on, he encamped in some villages of Judea. Finding them full of women and infants, he ordered his soldiers to butcher them, cut them into pieces, and then throw the limbs into boiling cauldrons and taste them. He gave this order so that those who escaped the battle and came upon the scene would believe their enemies were cannibals and be all the more terrified at the sight. Strabo and Nicolaus both report that this is indeed how he treated them, exactly as I have already stated. Ptolemy's forces also took Ptolemais by storm, as I have made clear elsewhere. Cleopatra, seeing her son growing in power, freely ravaging Judea, and holding the city of Gaza in submission, would not stand by while he stood at her gates, hungry to make himself greater than the Egyptians. She set out against him at once with both a naval and a land force, appointing the Jews Chalcias and Ananias as commanders of the whole army, while she sent most of her wealth, her grandsons, and her will ahead to be deposited on Kos. She ordered her son Alexander to sail with a great fleet along the coast to Phoenicia, while she herself came to Ptolemais with the rest of her army. When the people of Ptolemais refused to receive her, she laid siege to the city. Ptolemy meanwhile left Syria and hurried to Egypt, supposing he could seize it by surprise while it lay empty of troops, but he was mistaken in that hope. At this same time, it happened that Chalkias, the other of Cleopatra's commanders, died while pursuing Ptolemy near Celesyria. When Cleopatra learned of her son's venture, and that things in Egypt had not gone for him as he expected, she sent part of her army and drove him out of the country. He turned back from Egypt and spent the winter in Gaza. Meanwhile, Cleopatra took the garrison at Ptolemais by siege, along with the city itself. Alexander approached her with gifts and whatever courtesies were fitting for a man who had suffered badly at Ptolemy's hands and had no refuge but hers. Some of her friends advised her to take the country as well, now that she had come into it, and not to let so great a wealth of goods belonging to the Jews rest in the hands of one man. Ananias, however, advised against this, saying that she would be doing wrong if she stripped of his own authority a man who was her ally, and what is more, a kinsman of ours. "I do not want you to be unaware," he said, "that if you commit this injustice against him, you will turn all of us Jews into your enemies." Persuaded by this advice from Ananias, Cleopatra decided to do Alexander no wrong and instead made an alliance with him at Scythopolis in Celesyria. Freed now from his fear of Ptolemy, Alexander at once campaigned into Celesyria. He took Gadara after besieging it for 10 months, and he also took Amathus, the greatest of the strongholds beyond the Jordan, where Theodorus, son of Zeno, kept his finest and most valuable possessions. Theodorus fell upon the Jews when they were not expecting it, killed 10,000 of them, and plundered Alexander's baggage train. This did not daunt Alexander. Instead, he marched against the coastal towns of Raphia and Anthedon, which King Herod later renamed Agrippias, and took this one too by storm. Seeing that Ptolemy had withdrawn from Gaza to Cyprus and his mother Cleopatra to Egypt, and being angry at the people of Gaza for having called in Ptolemy as their ally, he besieged their city and plundered their territory beforehand. Apollodotus, the general of the Gazans, attacked the Jewish camp by night with 2,000 mercenaries and 10,000 of his own household troops, and for as long as the darkness lasted the Gazans had the better of it, giving the enemy the impression that Ptolemy himself had come against them. But when day broke and the deception was exposed, the Jews, learning the truth, rallied and attacked the Gazans, killing about 1,000 of them. The Gazans held their ground, giving way neither from want nor from the number of their dead, for they were prepared to suffer anything rather than fall under the enemy, and their resolve was further strengthened by the hope that Aretas, king of the Arabs, would soon arrive as their ally. But it happened that Apollodotus was killed first. His own brother Lysimachus, jealous of his standing among the citizens, murdered him, gathered a body of soldiers, and handed the city over to Alexander. Alexander, once inside, kept quiet at first, but afterward, he unleashed his troops on the Gazans and let them take their revenge. The others scattered through the city, killing Gazans wherever they turned. But the Gazans, too, were not lacking in courage, and in defending themselves against those who fell upon them, they destroyed no fewer of the Jews than they lost themselves. Some, isolated, set fire to their own houses so that the enemy would find no plunder in them. Others became the killers of their own children and wives, driven to spare them in this way from slavery under the enemy. The members of the city council, 500 in all, had fled together to the temple of Apollo, for it happened that the attack came while they were in session there. Alexander killed them, razed the city to the ground on top of them, and returned to Jerusalem after a siege of a full year. At about this same time, Antiochus, called Gripus, died, the victim of a plot by Heraclian, having lived 45 years and reigned 29. His son Seleucus succeeded to the kingdom and went to war with his father's brother Antiochus, who was called Cyzicenus. He defeated him, took him captive, and had him killed. Not long afterward, Cyzicenus's son Antiochus, called Eusebes, arrived at Aretas, put on the diadem, and made war on Seleucus. He prevailed and drove him out of the whole of Syria. Seleucus fled to Cilicia, and once settled at the shrine of Mopsus, he began again to extort money from the people there. The people of Mopsuscha, enraged, set fire to his palace and killed him along with his friends. While Antiochus, son of Cyzicenus, was reigning over Syria, Antiochus, the brother of Seleucus, made war against him, and being defeated, perished along with his army. After him, his brother Philip put on the diadem and ruled over part of Syria. Ptolemy Lathyrus summoned their third brother, Demetrius, called Acheros, from Cnidus and set him up as king in Damascus. Antiochus, resisting these two brothers with vigor, soon died. He had gone as an ally to Laodice, queen of the Samnians, in her war against the Parthians, and fell fighting bravely. Syria was now held by the two brothers, Demetrius and Philip, as I have related elsewhere. As for Alexander, his own people rose in rebellion against him. It happened at a festival, while he was standing at the altar about to offer sacrifice, that the people pelted him with citrons. For it is the law among the Jews that at the Feast of Tabernacles, each man should carry branches of palm and citron, as I have also explained elsewhere. They further heaped abuse on him, saying he was descended from captives and unworthy of his honor and of the priesthood. Enraged at this, he killed about 6,000 of them, and he built a wooden barrier around the altar and the temple, up to the balustrade beyond which only priests were permitted to go, and by means of this barrier, he shut off the crowd's access to him. He also kept foreign mercenaries, Pisidians and Cilicians, since he was at war with the Syrians and so made no use of them. After subduing the Moabites and Gileadites among the Arabs and reducing them to tribute, he tore down Amathus as well, since Theodorus did not dare to face him in battle. But when he joined battle against Obedas, king of the Arabs, he fell into an ambush in rough and difficult country and was driven by a mass of camels into a deep ravine near the village of Gadara in Gaulonitis, barely escaping with his life. From there, he fled and made his way to Jerusalem. Since the nation attacked him precisely because of his misfortune, he fought against them for 6 years and killed no fewer than 50,000 Jews. When he called on them to end their hostility toward him, they hated him only the more because of what had already happened. Asked what they wanted, they all cried out that he should die, and they sent to Demetrius Acheros asking for his alliance. Demetrius came with an army, took under his command those who had summoned him, and encamped near the city of Shechem. Alexander, taking with him 6,200 mercenaries and about 20,000 Jews who supported him, marched out against Demetrius. Demetrius had 3,000 cavalry and 40,000 infantry. Both sides worked hard, Alexander trying to win over the mercenaries to desert, since they were Greeks, Demetrius trying to win over the Jews who were with Alexander. Neither succeeded in persuading the other's men, and when they joined battle, Demetrius won. All of Alexander's mercenaries died, giving proof at once of their loyalty and their courage, and many of Demetrius's soldiers fell as well. As Alexander fled into the mountains, 6,000 Jews gathered to his side out of pity at his reversal of fortune. Demetrius, alarmed at this, withdrew. Afterward, the Jews continued to make war on Alexander, and being defeated, many of them died in the fighting. He shut up the strongest of them in the city of Bethom and besieged it. When he took the city and gained control of them, he brought them up to Jerusalem and there committed the most brutal act of all. While feasting in full view of everyone with his concubines, he ordered about 800 of them crucified, and while they still hung there alive, he had their children and wives slaughtered before their eyes. He did this in revenge for the wrongs he had suffered, but the punishment he exacted went beyond what any human being should inflict. Even granting, as was likely enough, that he had been worn down by his wars against them, and had come to the very brink of losing both his life and his kingdom, since they were not content to fight him themselves, but brought in foreigners as well. And in the end, forced things to such a point that he had to hand over to the Arab king the land he had conquered in Gilead and Moab, along with the Arab territories, so that the king would not join them in the war against him, along with countless other insults and injuries they inflicted on him. Even so, he does not seem to have acted properly in this, so that because of the excess of his cruelty, the Jews nicknamed him Thracidas. His opponents, about 8,000 in number, fled by night, and for as long as Alexander lived they remained in exile. And so he, rid of this turmoil, ruled from then on in complete peace. Demetrius, after leaving Judea, went to Berea and besieged his brother Philip there, having with him 10,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry. Stratton, the tyrant of Berea, an ally of Philip's, called Inazazus, Phylarch of the Arabs, and Mithridate Cinesis, the Parthian governor. These arrived with a large force and besieged Demetrius within his own entrenchment, pressing him inside with arrows and thirst until they forced him and his men to surrender. After plundering the countryside and taking Demetrius captive, they sent him to Mithridates, then king of the Parthians, and returned free of charge to the Antiochians those of the prisoners who turned out to be citizens of Antioch. Mithridates, king of the Parthians, held Demetrius in every honor until Demetrius ended his life through illness. Philip, immediately after the battle, went to Antioch, took possession of it, and became king of Syria. Then Antiochus, called Dionysus, Philip's brother, laid claim to the rule and came to Damascus. Gaining control of affairs there, he made himself king. When he set out on campaign against the Arabs, his brother Philip, hearing of it, came to Damascus. Antiochus met them and fought hard, and though winning, he died coming to the aid of the hard-pressed wing. When Antiochus fell, his army fled to the village of Cana, where most of them perished from hunger. After him, Aretas was made king of Celesyria, called to the throne by the people who held Damascus because of their hatred of Ptolemy son of Menes. Marching from there against Judea, he defeated Alexander in battle near the village of Adida and withdrew from Judea under a treaty. Alexander then marched again against the city of Diem and took it, and campaigning against Essa, where Zeno kept most of his valuables, he surrounded the place with three walls and took the city without a fight, then set out against Gaulane and Seleucia. Taking these as well, he seized also the ravine called Antiochus's and the fortress of Gamala. Bringing many charges against Demetrius, the ruler of the region, he stripped him of his post, and having now completed the third year of the campaign, he returned home, welcomed eagerly by the Jews because of his success. At this time, the Jews already held cities of the Syrians, Idumeans, and Phoenicians. On the coast, Strato's Tower, Apollonia, Joppa, Jamnia, Azotus, Gaza, Anthedon, Raphia, and Rhinocorora. Inland in Idumea, Adora and Marissa, and all of Idumea. Samaria, Mount Carmel, Mount Tabor, Scythopolis, and Gadara. In Gaulonitis, Seleucia, and Gabala. In Moab, Heshbon, Medaba, Lemba, Oroname, Jeliathan, and Zor. The Valley of the Cilicians, and Pella. This last city he razed to the ground, because its inhabitants would not promise to adopt the ancestral customs of the Jews. Other leading cities of Syria had likewise been overthrown. After this, King Alexander fell from heavy drinking into sickness, and for 3 years, gripped by a quartan fever, he did not give up his campaigns, until, worn out by his hardships, he died in the territory of Gerasa while besieging the fortress of Ragaba across the Jordan. Seeing him at the point of death, with no hope of recovery left to hold to, the queen wept and beat her breast, lamenting the desolation to come for herself and her children, and said to him, "To whom do you leave me and my children like this, in need of help from others? And this though you know how hostile the nation is toward you." He advised her to be guided by whatever counsel would let her hold the kingdom securely with her children, and to conceal his death from the soldiers until she had taken the fortress. Then, arriving at Jerusalem as if in splendor from a victory, to grant the Pharisees some measure of power. For since they would praise her in return for the honor, they would make the nation well disposed toward her. The Pharisees, he said, had great influence among the Jews, both to harm those they hated and to help those they favored, since the people trusted them above all when they said anything harsh out of envy against someone. He said that he himself had come into collision with the nation because of them, since they had felt insulted by him. "You then," he said, "once you are at Jerusalem, send for their leaders, and showing them my body, allow them, with full assurance of your good faith, to do with it whatever they wish, whether they choose to disgrace my corpse by leaving it unburied, as one who has made them suffer much, or to inflict some other outrage on my body out of anger. Promise them, too, that you will do nothing in the kingdom apart from their judgment. If you say this to them, I will be honored with a more splendid funeral at their hands than I would have received from you, and they will do nothing to abuse my body though it lies in their power, while you will rule securely." Having given his wife this advice, he died, having reigned 27 years and lived 51 in all. Alexandra took the fortress in accordance with her husband's instructions and conferred with the Pharisees, placing in their hands everything concerning both the corpse and the kingdom. By this, she put an end to their anger against Alexander and made them well-disposed and friendly. Coming before the people, they made speeches recounting Alexander's deeds and declared that a just king had died on their behalf, and by their praises stirred the people to mourning and grief for him, so that they gave him a more splendid funeral than any king before him. Alexander, however, left two sons, Hyacinus and Aristobulus, and settled the kingdom on Alexandra. Of his sons, Hyacinus was too weak to manage affairs and preferred a quiet life, while the younger, Aristobulus, was vigorous and bold. The people were fond of the woman, because she seemed displeased at the wrongs her husband had committed. She appointed Hyacinus high priest because of his age, but far more because of his lack of energy, and entrusted everything to the Pharisees, whom she also ordered the people to obey. And whatever of the traditional ordinances, her father-in-law Hyacinus had abolished ordinances which the Pharisees had introduced according to the tradition of the fathers. This she restored again. So the title of the kingdom was hers, but the power belonged to the Pharisees, for they recalled exiles, released prisoners, and in short differed in nothing from rulers. The queen, for her part, also took thought for the kingdom. She raised a large force of mercenaries and doubled her own army, so as to overawe the neighboring rulers and take hostages from them. The whole country was at peace, except for the Pharisees, for they kept stirring up the queen, urging her to put to death those who had advised Alexander to kill the 800 men. They themselves then slaughtered one of these men, Diogenes, and after him others one after another, until the men of influence together with Aristobulus, who plainly could not bear what was happening and made this evident, being determined, should he ever get the chance, not to let his mother continue, came before the palace and reminded her of the great deeds they had accomplished amid so many dangers, by which they had shown the firmness of their loyalty to their master, deeds for which they had been most highly honored by him. They begged her not to turn their hopes entirely to the opposite course, for having escaped the danger of enemies, they were being cut down at home by their foes like cattle, with no one to avenge them. They said that if their accusers were satisfied with those already killed, they would bear what had happened with moderation, out of loyalty to their rulers. But if the accusers meant to pursue the same course further, they asked above all to be granted release, for they could not bring themselves to secure their safety apart from it, but would gladly die before the palace rather than be thought guilty of disloyalty toward her. It would be a disgrace, they said, both to us and to the reigning queen, if, neglected by her, we were handed over to our master's enemies. For Aretas the Arab and the other rulers would pay any price to hire away so many men, men whose very name had perhaps once struck terror before it was even heard. But if not, then at the very least, if she has resolved to give the Pharisees preference, let her station each of us in the fortresses. For if some divine anger has indeed fallen in this way upon the house of Alexander, we ourselves can at least show that we are living in a humble condition. While they said many such things, invoking the spirits of Alexander to pity the dead and those in danger, all who stood around broke into tears, and above all Aristobulus made his feelings plain, reproaching his mother at length. But in truth, those men had themselves become the cause of their own misfortunes, having allowed, out of a woman's love of power, one who by rights should not have reigned to rule while the royal line was in its prime. She, for her part, not knowing what else to do while keeping up appearances, entrusted the guarding of the fortresses to them, except for Hyacinia, Alexandrian, and Machaerus, where her most valuable possessions were kept. Not long after, she sent her son Aristobulus with an army against Damascus, against the man called Ptolemy son of Menius, who was a troublesome neighbor to the city, but they accomplished nothing worth the effort and returned. At this time word came that Tigranes had invaded Syria with 300,000 troops and was about to arrive in Judea. This, as was natural, alarmed the queen and the nation. They sent him many gifts, worth mentioning, along with envoys, while he was besieging Ptolemais, for Queen Selene, also called Cleopatra, who then held sway over parts of Syria. The one who had induced the inhabitants to shut Tigranes out was the object of his siege, and the envoys begged him to look kindly on the queen and the nation. He received them, and though keeping his distance in his dealings, held out good hopes to them. Ptolemais had only just been captured when word came to Tigranes that Lucullus, pursuing Mithridates, had failed to catch him, since he had fled to the Iberians, but that Lucullus had ravaged Armenia and was besieging it. Learning this as well, Tigranes withdrew homeward. After this, when the queen fell into a serious illness, Aristobulus resolved to seize control of affairs. Slipping away by night with one of his servants, he went to the fortresses where his father's friends had been stationed, for he had long chafed at what his mother was doing and feared far more that, once she died, the whole family would fall into the hands of the Pharisees. He saw the impossibility of his brother, who was to succeed to the rule, actually holding it. Only his wife knew of the plan, and he left her behind there with their children. Arriving first at Agaba, where Gallistes, one of the powerful men, was in command, he was received by him. The next day the queen learned of Aristobulus's flight, and for a time supposed that his withdrawal was not aimed at revolution. But when messenger after messenger came reporting that he had seized the first fortress, and the second, and all of them in turn, for once one had begun, everything rushed swiftly toward fulfilling his purpose. Then indeed the queen and the nation fell into the greatest turmoil. For they knew that Aristobulus was not far from being able to secure the throne for himself, and they feared he would exact punishment for the wrongs they had urged upon his household. It was resolved, then, to place his wife and children in the fortress above the temple. As for Aristobulus, since he was joined by great numbers from many quarters, from whom he now had a royal retinue about him, he mastered, in about 15 days, 22 strongholds. And having gained this advantage, he gathered an army from Lebanon, Trachonitis, and the local rulers for these men, being easily swayed by superior numbers, readily obeyed him. And besides, they reckoned that if they joined forces with him, they would reap no less a share of the kingdom than he himself, since they had become the occasion of his rising to power. The elders of the Jews, together with Hyrcanus, went to the queen and begged her to give her judgment on the present situation. For Aristobulus, they said, was now virtually master of everything, since he had gained control of so many strongholds. And it was absurd, even if she were gravely ill, that they should have to deliberate on their own while she still lived, when the danger stood close upon them, not far off. She told them to do whatever seemed useful to them. Many resources, she said, were still left to them, the nation strong, the army intact, and the money in the treasuries, for she herself now cared little for affairs, since her body was already failing. Having said this, she died not long after, having reigned 9 years and lived 73 years in all a woman who in nothing made use of the weakness proper to her sex. For being especially formidable in her love of power, she proved by her deeds both the practical strength of her own judgment and the folly of men who forever stumble in their pursuit of dominion, valuing the present above the future, and putting everything second to ruling with a firm hand, with no regard for what was honorable or just on its own account. At all events, she reduced her house to such a pitch of misfortune that the rule which she had acquired amid the greatest dangers and hardships, through a desire for what did not befit a woman, was taken away not long after, adding to those, already hostile, toward her family a like resentment, and leaving the throne bereft of those who might have watched over it. She filled both her own reign, and, after her death, the kingdom with troubles and turmoil arising from the policies of her lifetime. Nevertheless, for all that, she kept the nation in peace and quiet while she ruled. Such, then, was the end of the story of Queen Alexandra. I now go on to relate what happened to her sons, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, after her death, in the book that follows this one.